Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches. Hello and welcome to Access Utah. I'm your Monday morning host, Brian Earl, and with me today in studio is Dan Dross. He's USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist, and we'd love to have your questions or comments. Our toll-free number for this hour is 1-800-826-1495, or go online to upr.org, click on the Programs tab, and then Access Utah to send us your email question. Dan, thanks for coming in.
Yeah, good. Let's get some calls today because, you know, the garden is warming up and things are starting to pop, and you noted that the apricots are in bloom, and I've got asparagus popping out of the ground, and, you know, things are happening.
And a lot earlier than the last couple of years,
yeah,
that's for sure.
Yeah, last year it was like, you know, I think it was the 20th of April before we saw any asparagus, and I was
that's
out.
That's crazy.
And then this year, here it is, it was last Thursday that I've noticed the first ones coming up. And so it's like, goodness me, what a almost a month different, you know, from last year. So when we talk about normal, there is no such thing as normal. All normal means is that you take a many years and you average it all out and say that that's normal. And, you know, we all know that there's no such thing. So,
well, let's talk about some of those issues that we're going to experience with crops popping up now, because it's going to get cold. I guarantee it.
It'll... Yeah. You know, last night, I think it was probably in the high 20s here.
Unless you're in Hyde Park and it was 22.
Was it 22?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I was just thinking about the farm and you know, we've got all this asparagus coming up in my research plots, and it was up about 2 inches above the soil line. And so if it was in the, you know, say 29 or 30, I wouldn't get too concerned about that. Usually there's enough heat that's by the soil that it's okay. But boy, if you had 22 in Hyde Park, I would suspect that, you know, we probably were in the 24 degree range, and I'll go out there and see all the tips blacken back, and that's basically it for another week. So that's, you know, kind of the problem that we have when things happen so early and you're not really expecting it. You know, maybe you could have done something to protect it. You know, we had talked about in previous years, one of the things that we've been doing is putting a plastic row cover over top of those to protect it. You know, you get a lot of heat built up in the soil. During the day, the plastic warms the air more underneath that and also transmits more heat down into the soil. And then at night, when it's colder, the soil loses some of that heat back up in underneath the tunnel. And if the air is still, it gets trapped underneath there, and that can change your temperature sometimes by 3 or 4 degrees. And that's sometimes all it takes. However, if it's 22 or 24, 3 or 4 degrees does not the asparagus keep from freezing. So, you know, you just have to kind of cope with these things, and here's another anomaly year, you know, probably one of the warmest Marches on record. I don't know, you know, maybe Dr. Gillies can talk about that in one of the weather updates, you know, give us a history of that kind of thing, because it was unseasonably warm in March, and I wasn't expecting that.
Well, and for some of us, it's kind of thank goodness, because I put leaves on the garden in the fall and did not get them tilled in.
Uh-huh.
So at least fortunately now the garden is dried out enough that I can get in and till it, and was able to get some peas and lettuce and parsnip planted a couple of weeks ago. But they're just now popping up.
Yeah, and I wouldn't be too worried about those guys getting, you know, touched by the frost or anything like that. You know, those are crops that we call hardy vegetables. You know, they're robust enough, and they, you know, have been growing in colder or cooler type soil, so, you know, they're somewhat acclimated to that. You know, it's when we get a long stretch of this really cold type weather where we have high pressure setting over us and it's clear and the days are modestly warm and the nights are still going down into the, you know, low 20s, that's when things, you know, start to really impact how these plants perform in the garden. So, you know, you know, we're on our way out of it. You know, the sun angle's getting higher. The day temperatures are warm. You know, we're starting to store energy in the soil. You know, that dark-colored soil absorbs it, so the temperature starts to rise a little bit. You know, we have less and less risk, but, you know, there still is risk. And, you know, you hate to see that first asparagus get frozen off because, you know, you're salivary glands are kind of going, oh, I can't wait to get you know, into that. And people are asking you, oh, is asparagus coming yet? You know, are we going to be able to, you know, buy some this year? And, you know, where can we get it? And when is it going to come on? And, you know, so it's just a little bit delayed again because we kind of we're antsy people. You know, we want it to be now. We want everything to happen. And yet, you know, the calendar really doesn't, you know, mesh too well with what you'd expect.
Well, we've been a whole 9.5, 10 months without fresh asparagus out of our garden, so no wonder why we're antsy.
Yeah, I understand that. You know, that part of it I can gather, but I'm just saying that if we look at that kind of normal, what's normal for northern Utah and the Salt Lake region and some of the mountain valleys that we have that our listeners are, you know, tuning in at, normal tends to tell us that, you know, usually about the end of March, you know, early April is when soils are beginning to dry out enough that we can go in and till, that we get our lettuce and our spinach and our peas planted. And, you know, if we can do it earlier, yeah, that's sometimes beneficial. And there are things that we have talked about over the years that say we could do it earlier. But, you know, the metabolic processes in the plant are relatively slow. And so, you know, trying to be too aggressive with getting things started without trying to protect the plants is really where we run into problems. And that's why we've often said, you know, use floating row covers, use small tunnels, you know, maybe build a high tunnel if you've got the space to do that at some point. So that what you really can do is, you know, kind of fill in that family's vegetable need from your own garden rather than what you have to purchase. And, you know, that's a cost savings to you. That's, you know, food that you know where it comes from. You know, it's just that much more enjoyable. It always seems to taste that much better when we can go out and pick it. And it's, you know, really, really fresh. And so, you know, that's what gets people excited. And that's what we want people to do. And yet, at the same time, you know, our environment, you know, 10 times throws us, you know, sliders that, you know, we swing on and miss. And so to speak, it's got to get that baseball stuff in here because it's in that start. I think it's opening day today. So I was like, oh, man, how do you get a good baseball metaphor into the gardening talk? You know, well, it threw us a slider last night in many ways. And, you know, so the asparagus is kind of knocked back, but it's not like it's gone. That's the beauty of some of these plants, you know, these perennial plants, you know. There's lots of buds below ground that are just kind of waiting for things to happen, and it's going to be nicer this week again. It's going to warm up a little bit, and they'll start to grow, and, you know, we'll still get a big asparagus harvest, and we'll be excited about that.
Well, the nice thing in my garden is my asparagus isn't up yet.
Yeah, well, you know, that's the difference between how old it is, because one thing that we do know about asparagus is that, you know, young plants tend to, you know, kind of be like your teenage son. You know, it's hard for him to get out of bed in the morning.
Okay, well, that would explain it, because I've only had them in three or four years.
And so. I know yours is a relatively young planting yet, whereas my older planting is, you know, kind of programmed to do things a little bit faster, and surprisingly older blocks tend to start emerging a little bit earlier. And I think my planting isn't, you know, at the research station is, you know, in its 13th year, so that's the difference between those two. So it's going to want to grow a little bit faster, and it's got a bigger root system, and it's, you know, just kind of been around a lot longer.
So how do you treat your teenage asparagus bed or your older bed? I mean, what's the best way to make sure that, in my case, I've got a little more clay in the soil, yeah. So I think that also inhibits the growth. And I wanted to put on some kind of a mulch so that the ground top stays a little bit more easy for it to pop up through, but I don't want to cool it off either.
Yeah, one of the things, we've been working on a project where we've been looking at trying to grow asparagus a little bit more organically, you know, and one of the treatments that we have in that is a straw mulch. And what we note with the straw mulch, we have about 6 inches of decomposed and decomposing and fresh straw that's kind of layered on top of each other, because each fall we often will apply some more straw in there. We're using it to try and smother out the weeds because we're not wanting to spray herbicides in the system to control the weeds. And that's a kind of a big issue in a perennial planting like asparagus that's going to come year after year. If you've got bindweed, if you've got quack grass, you know, what do you do with those things? So we've been putting this straw mulch on top of the beds. And what we've noted is about a 10-day delay in emergence.
That's now, quite a while.
Yeah, 10 days is, you don't think of it as very long, but 10 days is pretty significant for something like asparagus. And that delay actually has impacted, you know, how many of the spears are damaged by frost. So one of our other treatments is where we till the soil alongside the beds in before the spears emerge, in an attempt to just kind of remove the weeds. And now we've got a bare soil. The idea with the bare soil is it's dark colored, it absorbs more heat, and therefore the spears start to emerge faster. Well, we lose more spears there to these early frosts because of that exposed component. Now we have another treatment where we have grass kind of in between the asparagus beds, and then we have kind of a tilled strip over top of the asparagus. And what we find with that one is that one's kind of intermediate, but sometimes when it gets pretty cold grass, you'll see frost on it, but you don't really see that on bare ground. And so we also have some damage in it. And so that kind of tells us that one of the things we can do to kind of delay things is to mulch it heavy. And hopefully by then what you've done is you've gotten through some of those colder early nights in the season, just like my asparagus now is coming up and it got hit with this cold weather that we had. We avoid losing some of those early spears, and generally those early spears are some of your larger ones. They tend to be, you know, a little bit thicker in size, and spear size kind of diminishes over the growing season, so they have more weight. And if you were a farmer selling asparagus is sold by the pound, so you'd like to have more spears that weigh more. And so you'd like to preserve those. So that's where it's given us the idea, and some of the farmers in Europe are using these low plastic tunnels over top of asparagus beds in an attempt to try and maintain a little bit earlier production, have less frost damage, and thereby get into the marketplace early when people say, oh, asparagus, I'd like to buy some of that. Where can I get it locally? Well, if you continually have these little frost events, your productivity is somewhat lower, and therefore you aren't going to really recoup that much money off of it. But if the cover can help you, that might be a way to circumvent the effects of the frost that we are often seeing.
So what kind of mulch would you use?
Well, it kind of depends on what your interests are. The big problem that we have when we use the clear plastic mulches as a little low tunnel out in the garden over top of the plants is we get a proliferation of weed growth underneath that. So if you're kind of into this organic approach where you say, well, I'm trying to minimize the amount of pesticides that I put into my garden, and I don't really want to use a herbicide or something like that, then you're going to either have to weed more, or you're going to have to take some other method of trying to rid yourself of those weeds. And some people use flaming technologies. We have that as one of our organic techniques. But, you know, as natural gas prices and propane prices go up, which they are doing, that becomes a more expensive option, too, because they're kind of tied to the world fuel costs. And we all know what fuel prices are like right now. So, you know, that maybe isn't an option for you, but it's a good organic approach. And some people would even say that it's not an organic sustainable approach because, you know, fuel is a limited resource. There's only so much of it that's there. And, you know, is that a best way to control these weeds? Maybe a different approach should be taken. So that comes back to the hoe or a scuffle hoe or something like that to try and remove some of those weeds, or just the old hand-picking approach. And some people say that that's too time-consuming. I want to go to something a little quicker. And so the straw was our idea of trying to deal with that, because we produce a lot of wheat in this state. We've got a lot of straw in the state. We know what it will do from an insulation purpose. The idea was to somewhat delay the emergence, and it's done exactly what we thought, to reduce the amount of, you know, early season frost losses that we've been noting over the many years that we've worked on asparagus. And then to go to the opposite extreme with the plastic tunnels, but that often requires us to come in with some herbicide underneath there, because otherwise the weeds get pretty big and it starts to get difficult to find the asparagus spears growing amongst the weeds. So do I have an answer for you? Kind of. Yes, if you noticed, I've been waffling around on this a little bit, because it really depends on what you're interested in. And we're taking the approach in our organic system, okay, we're going to try and use a technique that minimizes input costs, and the straw seems to be a good one for that, though I may not want to be delayed in my emergence. And then in our other plantings where we're using the low tunnels, well, we're going to a spray with some Roundup over top of the beds before the spears come up, because we always have a few weeds that are showing up there. And then some type of pre-emergent type herbicide that will, you know, create an environment that any new germinating weeds don't come up through. And so the Roundup helps control some of the perennials and some of those winter annuals that are there. And the pre-emerge tends to control those that are going to emerge in the next weeks or two. And that keeps our bed a little bit cleaner, so that it makes it easier for us to harvest it.
Well, so then, other than it delaying emergence for asparagus, I could use straw. That's not going to be a problem. I mean, can I still pick the season, or
yeah,
should I?
Okay. Yeah, it does what it's supposed to do. It kind of kept the weeds down. We had very little weed pressure in those plots. The spears will just push right up through the straw, because there's nothing to stop them from doing that. And we had an easy, clean environment to work with. One thing we have noted is that we do see a few more slugs and snails in that, because, you know, that's one of the problems with these mulches. It also keeps a moist, cool environment, and most of our slugs and snails like that, so they tend to be down there underneath the straw. And then they will, you know, in the late evening or early morning, they'll climb onto the spears, of course, and feed on them. So you do see a little bit of that damage. I mean, there's trade-offs with all of these things. So one of the approaches that some farmers do with the straw is kind of like what we do with strawberry. You mulch it heavy with straws over the winter to give the plant some protection. But then in the spring, when you're expecting the crop, you go in and you rake off the straw over top of the row so that there's no straw there, to try and ensure that the slugs and snails don't get a place to overnight stay. You know, basically it's a nice environment for them. So that moves them away, and it allows more radiant energy to get down into the soil to ensure that those spears start to grow. So at some point in time, you say to yourself, okay, I'm going to open it up, and then I'm going to let normal things happen. And then when the crop is over, I throw the straw back in top of the row. That will give me my mulch. That will give me my weed control. Because the interesting thing about the straw is there's very little weeds that are growing in that. It's a very effective weed control agent.
How many inches of straw should you put on?
Well, we've been putting on, 4 to 6 inches. And we'll do that in the fall. And
so that's actually quite a bit.
Yeah, it's a thick mulch. And the idea with the thick mulch is that there are probably some weeds that are escaping. You want to try and smother those. And that has worked really pretty well for us. And so, and then by the springtime, it starts to decompose a little bit. And you'll have, maybe 3 or 4 inches there by the springtime. And then over the course of the summer, as you do things, it, you know, rots down even more. And then, you know, you put on some more in the fall again. And so it's worked quite nicely as a mulch for that. And, you know, could be used around things like artichokes if you're trying to overwinter your artichokes. You know, it's a good mulch in and around rhubarb. One of the problems we see with rhubarb, it's pretty shallow rooted, and as the temperatures get a little bit warmer, you know, then the petiole quality tends to decrease. You get a little bit more stringy, it's a little bit more sour and bitter, because you know, the plant root system in the crown of that a rhubarb plant is in a warmer environment than it really likes.
Well, we have our first caller on the line. We have Margaret from Vernal. Hi, Margaret. How can we help?
Well, I was going to ask about the straw. Do you cut it into small lengths, or do you put it on as it comes out of the
the bales?
The bales.
Yeah, we just take it, and we just, I don't do any extra work. So, you know, you get a bale, and you break the bale open, and then we just fluff it around, take the hay fork, and just make sure that it's loose. We don't throw the big individual slices, so to speak, right over top of the bed. We just fluff it out, but we don't do any cutting of it or anything like that. We just kind of let it naturally decompose, and if that takes, you know, a year or 2 years or whatever, we don't really care. It's just there for that weed control, for moisture management, you know, to keep the soil environment, you know, a little bit cooler so that we get the nice growth.
Yeah. So it basically, as it comes off the combine or the...
That's correct.
Bridge, then, yeah.
That's correct. So, and, you know, it...
Could be 2 or 3, maybe 3 or 4 feet even.
Well, yeah, about, you know, if your row width is about a foot wide, we usually go out about another foot on either side of that so that you get a good coverage of it. And as I said, when you fluff it up, we usually like to have about 4 to 6 inches of straw, you know, so it's loose. It's not just the individual slices that you would get off the baler when it puts together. And, you know, and some people at the, you know, your local farm supply place, you can buy straw. If you don't have a farmer that you know, you can go to, and, you know, it's not expensive. So, and for a small garden, you know, it's relatively inexpensive because you only may need a bale or two to be able to get enough straw on over top of some of your perennial stuff.
I'm familiar with that part of it. I just wondered whether you cut it up into small pieces.
No, so that's, you know, it's too much faster. work, you know. I know some people that have done that. You know, if you've got a leaf chipper or something like that, you know, they'll flail it through that thing in an attempt to, you know, make smaller particles of it. It breaks down faster. That's the beauty of it that way. But I'm not really worried about how quickly it breaks down. I'm more interested in keeping moisture underneath it and also keeping, you know, the weeds down.
Yes. Back in England on the farm, we used to have a chaff cutter.
Oh, yeah, right.
Cut up the straw, and I just wondered whether you use something like that.
No, I think it's just more work than you need to do for your garden. That's for
sure. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Margaret.
Thanks, Margaret.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, we're reaching the halfway point already, and exactly. We get talking about asparagus and the type of
You know, people laugh at me because I can talk forever about asparagus, but you know, that so be it.
Well, you're listening to Access Utah. Dan Drost is USU's Extension Garden Specialist, Vegetable Specialist, and if you'd like to call him with a question or comment, the toll free number is 1-800-826-1495, or go online to upr.org, click on the Programs tab, and then you'll see Access Utah. Right now, we have the next edition of Wild About Utah, and then we'll be back for the second half of the program, so stay tuned.
Welcome to Wild About Utah, a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio.
This is Linda Kirvin for Bridgerland Audubon Society. Tiny scuds abound in Utah's waters, their flattened, flea-like bodies allowing them to scramble and tumble giddily under the surface. These crustaceans in the order Amphipoda can be up to a half inch in length. Also known as freshwater shrimp and side swimmers, scuds look like minuscule, flattened shrimp with orderly ranks of leg-like appendages. Some of these legs can grip, and are used for climbing and to anchor in the water. The front two pairs have tiny flaps to clasp their food while dining. The middle legs are for swimming. The hindmost legs can be used to kick off against surfaces, propelling the scud forward. All this exuberant movement helps scuds dodge predators and provides them with their common name. To scud under sail is to move swiftly before a gale. The blowing foam at the crest of waves is called scud. Evasive acrobatics are vital, since scuds are a favorite food of many fish. Half of a trout's annual diet can consist of scuds. No wonder anglers use lures that mimic them. Scud's coloration matches their habitat, with browns and greens most common. When newly molted, they are semi-transparent and baby blue. The female has a brood sac called a marsupium, where she holds her eggs for fertilization and incubation. Fertilized eggs are usually bright orange. The newly hatched young are tiny versions of their parents. In Utah, look for scuds in still water and in the calmer water along edges of streams and rivers. Prime habitat offers an abundance of submergent vegetation for concealment and plenty of plant and animal debris on which to scavenge. Our alkaline waters are rich in dissolved calcium carbonate, which scuds incorporate into their chitinous exoskeleton. To get a good look at these fascinating acrobats, catch them with a simple aquarium net and place them in a pan of water with some vegetation. Links for more information can be found at our Wild About Utah website. This is Linda Kirvin for Bridgerland Audubon Society.
Wild About Utah is a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio. For transcripts and archived audio of Wild About Utah, go online to upr.org and click on the Wild About Utah link. Support for Wild About Utah comes from the College of Natural Resources at Utah State University. Information is at cnr.usu.edu.
Welcome back to the second half of Access Utah today. I'm Brian Earle, your host, and Dan Drost is my guest. He's the USU Extension Vegetable Specialist, and we're taking any gardening question you might have. It's 1-800-826-1495 or online at upr.org. Okay, so let's continue our asparagus topic just a little bit more before we move on to something else, because this next point is very important. Don't listen to your grandmother when it comes to picking asparagus.
My grandmother probably wouldn't agree with that. She's been dead a few years now, but you know, even before that, it was always listen to grandmother and don't argue with her. But on the point of asparagus picking, grandma's advice is usually wrong. And that advice comes back to how you should harvest, first of all, and secondly, how long you should harvest, and thirdly, what you should do with stuff that you don't deem suitable for your plate.
Is there such a thing as unsuitable asparagus?
I don't believe there is. So if we talk about the unsuitability, that has to do with, you know, pick what you pick, and you really should pick every spear that comes up. As soon as it gets 7 to 9 inches tall, you should cut it off, and another spear will come. And if you leave any spears out in the garden, what ends up happening is they send a signal to the bud cluster that they come from to say, stop sending up more spears. So by leaving some out in the garden, what you effectively do is reduce your level of productivity. So by cutting everything and continually cutting everything, what you're going to do is have, you know, more production. The question about, you know, how long should you cut has to do with how much time do you need to grow good fern to replenish the root system. And so what we generally tell people is to pick until about the first week of June. And so that means pick every spear that comes up to the first of June. There's lots of spears on the asparagus plant. The root system is large. It's got lots of spears down there. The few that you're going to pick during the eating season isn't going to diminish that number very much. And so you'll get plenty of fern growth, which will recharge the system. And so what you really want to do is start, pick often, eat it fresh, eat it steamed, eat it roasted. Just eat it and then work your way. Make sure that you pick everything.
Well, the bee names are calling in this
Uh-oh.
Line. First, we have Bill, Brian, and Barbara on the line.
Oh, my dear.
The first one is Bill from Hyde Park. Hi, Bill. How can we help?
Hello. Just a short question. I've got a new bed, like a flower bed, on the north wall.
Yep.
What kind of vegetables or herbs would be good to grow in that shaded area?
That's
the question.
It's quite shady, huh? Well, you know, generally those are nice spots for the summer lettuce, you know. So, and the reason you want to do that is because lettuce and things like that don't really like the heat of summer. So some of those cool season crops that you would be planting now, you can plant quite late in to early May and actually have some that come on in June and July when it's still pretty hot. So, you know, it's a nice place for those types of things. For many of our fruiting vegetables, it's not a very good site. Down in St. George, I always recommend people plant on the north or the east side of their house, because then what they do is they get some morning sun, but they don't get that hot afternoon sun. But up here in northern Utah, we really shouldn't plant any fruiting vegetables on those north sides, because they just don't get enough light, and therefore they don't fruit very well. So go with your leafy vegetables, maybe some radishes through the summer. Some of those kinds of things will do quite nicely under that, because it's not so hot. And they can tolerate a little bit of shade as well.
All right, and thanks for the idea.
Okay, good enough.
Thanks, Bill.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Our next caller is Brian in Wellsville. Hi, Brian, how can we help?
Yes, how are you doing today?
Great.
Yes, my question, I have two actually. One is, can you transplant lovage? And the second one is, my garlic is about 8 to 10 inches tall. When do you put fertilizer on that?
Okay. Well, yeah, you can transplant lovage. You should probably have those plants started already. So if you haven't done that, get on it quickly here. Or just seed some as well, and you should be okay. With that. As for your garlic, the key things that you want to do right now are, you know, get some early nitrogen on it, because you want to really initiate lots of leaf growth. So in our extension website, we have a publication about garlic, and your last application of fertilizer should be somewhere around, you know, the 10th to the 15th of May. So an early April application is a great time to stimulate some leaf growth, to make sure your clove size is going to be large, and then a second application in around mid-May, because your garlic is going to mature off and be ready for harvest generally around the 1st of July. And you don't want to put on too much late nitrogen. And so the fact sheet that we have on our extension website gives you those kinds of numbers for application amounts.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You have access to that website. You know where that is?
Yeah.
Go to usu.edu and then look for extension. Or once you get to the USU website, just go garlic in the search engine, and then it should pop right up to you.
Okay.
All righty. Thanks.
Great. Thanks for your call. Next we go to Barbara in Hiram. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. First, let me say I'm so glad that the dreaded fundraising is over.
Oh, my dear, Barbara.
We can have a whole hour of gardening.
Well, okay. You know, that is probably the good part. Yeah.
That's right. I just hope they made enough money. Anyway, I need a primer on raising artichokes in this Cache Valley neck of the woods. I didn't know you could do it, but I'd heard Brian talk about it several times.
Yeah, I think, you know, I did write a publication on that, so there's more detail if you go to the website and then,
okay,
and then look at artichoke. So that's all that information is free. You probably want to put it in one of your favorite lists and stuff like that. Or if you're, you know, just too tired of going to look on the computer all the time, you can go to the extension office in town here. And what they did is we bound all of those publications into a ring binder and everything's right there. So you may want to do that if you want all of that stuff.
Well, so then, okay, I'll do that. I'll go online. But
yeah.
So is it a perennial?
It is a perennial.
Like the decorative onions? Or?
Yes, it is a perennial. However, it is not a hardy perennial. So under our cold environmental conditions here, oftentimes in the winter it freezes out. And so you got to go to extraordinary lengths to try and get it to go from year to year. And the publication talks about that part of it. The other thing is we really like to start it from a transplant. And I know that at some of the nurseries and some of the garden centers, and I've even seen it at places like Lowe's and Home Depot, but it's only in for about 1 week. You got to kind of look for it. And when it's there, you can buy plants that are already started. But they don't buy an awful lot. And the trick with artichokes is it needs to be planted out pretty early. And normally we would transplant it right around this first week or so of April. And the reason we do that is it needs some chilling in order for it to produce a flower stalk. If we plant it too late, like if we wait a month and plant it in early May, it doesn't get enough cold, and so it'll just grow vegetatively without the flower. And you really want the flower so that you can get the buds, which are what we're going to eat.
Right, but if it doesn't produce flower the first year, it would the next year, we assume, right?
Only if it makes it through the winter.
Oh, yeah, right. Okay.
So that's the caveat on it.
On the south side where there's some masonry that keeps, retains some heat, or just super mulching, or?
Well, it really likes a coolish kind of environment. It does better if it's in a cooler spot in it. So, the earlier caller that said, what could I stick on the north side of my house? Actually, artichoke probably would do better there, other than the fact that it's cooler all summer, and so you get a better quality bud. It does not usually produce as many flowers because it's more shady, so that's a drawback. And then from a protection point, if you're going to leave it there over winter, you really need to mulch it heavily. And so a lot of straw on top of it. We've taken where we've actually thrown soil on top of it so that it has maybe 6 inches of soil on top of the plant for the winter period in an attempt to try and minimize the amount of deep freezing that goes down into that root system, because it's not hardy enough here. And on the coast of California, where it never gets terribly cold, it does great there. And so sometimes we can make it over winter. Sometimes we can't.
Sometimes it just might be luck of the draw on what kind of winter we have, obviously.
Yes. And in an open winter like this winter was a bad winter for them because it's open. Actually, the years that we have more snow, it's better. So some people will, I know in Japan they grow it in cold environments, and what they do in the winter is they actually mulch it heavy with all these other things, and then they throw lots of snow on top of it because snow is a pretty good insulator and it doesn't get that cold underneath it.
Okay, I'll go online and check it out.
Good luck.
Great,
thanks,
Barbara. I was just noticing that the easy way to get to the extension website is garden.usu.edu.
Right.
That's pretty easy.
That's the easy way to get there.
So it gives you a lot of options for...
And then there's all kinds of stuff once you get in there.
Soils, vegetables and herbs, lawns, weeds, insects and diseases, trees and shrubs, flowers. I mean, you just name it. And then there is a good search engine here, too.
That's right. And so once you get to garden.usu.edu, or if you just go to the USU website, and then you type in whatever your keyword is. So if you want something on garlic, you would just go garlic, and then there's going to be a bunch of stuff. But usually my fact sheets are one of the ones that pop up first on that. And then, they're about 2 pages long, and they tell you just about everything you need to know, what some of the problems you may experience, when to fertilize, how much to fertilize, how much to water, what to do about weeds, more stuff than I can talk about here. It would take me kind of the whole gardening program to just talk about garlic if we did that. So, really the listeners need to kind of use that resource, because we've developed that so that, I can give you the 2 cent version here on air, but you really want the $10 version, and the bulletin has the $10 version.
Well, we've only got about 10 minutes left in the program. If you'd like to call with a question or comment, it's 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. or go online to upr.org, click on the Programs tab, and you'll see the Access Utah link. Now, we do have a question online.
Oh, good.
Also, another bee name, Brooke.
Oh, it has been the day of the bees, you know? I was hoping the bees would fly around on my my apricot, which is in bloom. So they were going on Saturday, but they weren't doing anything yesterday.
Well, and this one, I'm not quite sure. I mean, you've got a lot of expertise, but this happens to be about a linden tree. So we'll go for it and see what happens.
My standard answer before I hear the question is one pruning cut.
You don't like lindens?
I don't like lindens.
Oh, okay.
But then that's just me. So I wouldn't have one in my yard if it was that. So
well, she says, we have a large linden tree in our front yard. It was here when my husband bought the house 10 years ago. We guess it's at least 25 years old.
Uh-huh.
We've noticed the last few years the main trunk seems to be growing bulges, and it's covered with an orangish fungus.
Ooh.
Do you have any thoughts on what might be happening? Is this something we should be concerned about? It's a beautiful shade tree. We would be sad to lose it.
Yeah, that would be a great question for Claudia or, I don't know enough about diseases of trees. I mean, you know, if you ask me diseases of vegetables, I can help you there. But for some of these fruit or for some of these tree diseases, I am not really sure. But that doesn't sound
good. Sounds like a flux.
Yeah, I don't know.
And so that would be nice.
But one of the things you can do is, you know, take a picture of it. And then I know that under the gardening.usu, there's a thing on trees, and there are also some things on some of the common tree problems that it may have some information there. So you could, by going to the website, or better yet, take some pictures of this and take them down to the extension office, and the horticulturalist at the extension office can help. And if he can't, then what you can do is, as you start seeing some of that oozing, or you can see some of that, whatever is coming out of that bulges on the side of these trees, we can get that up to the diagnostic lab so that they can make an appropriate diagnosis of the problem, and then they often will tell you what to do to solve the problem as well. And so, you know, go through the website, go to our local county extension office and ask for the horticulturalist, and they have, you know, diagnostic stuff that they do, and he knows a lot more about trees because his background is in the nursery industry, and so he did work on trees. That's what he worked on, and I don't work on trees, so I don't have an answer for the write-in caller.
There, I just clicked on the garden.usu.edu. I typed in linden and then disease, and I've got a whole list of things to look at.
I mean, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, there's more stuff on that website. So that's where I would start. And I apologize for not knowing anything
about trees.
Well, it's
time for me to bring Mike Coons in so we
can
talk.
Yeah.
So, okay. So we have about 8 minutes left in the program, and I wanted to move along and talk about some of our issues like storage issues for seeds, and basically what to throw out if you've carried some over from the previous
year. You were telling me beforehand that you had planted some peas and you had seed from 2008, and that you've planted them and some of them have come up. So,
and I planted them really thick.
Really thick. So you expect the germination not to be so well. So you'll be surprised if you have a very thick patch of peas. So, you know, you may have to do some thinning if a lot of them have come up, but if not very many of them come up, you know, one or two, you know, that doesn't help you any either. So normally what we would recommend is things like the squash family of plants and the melon family of plants. You can store those seeds for up to 5 years at least. If you are growing things like tomatoes and peppers, they store for 5 years or more. If you're buying seeds like lettuce and some of those small-seeded vegetables, onions, parsnips, it's best to buy fresh seed every year. And if you do have seed that you've stored under appropriate conditions, being cool and dry, you know, often I recommend that you can either test the germination on them yourselves, and you just wrap it in a paper towel, stick it in a warm place like on top of your refrigerator, put a plastic bag around it, and then kind of put a set number of seeds in it and then see how many actually grow a little root. That will tell you something about how well they're doing. And then always maybe sow a few extra out in the garden, you know. So if it says space them 2 inches apart, rather than do that, space them 1 inch apart. And if they all come up, thin it back to the appropriate plant stand. But that way, at least you're going to be ensured that you get enough plants, because there's nothing worse than saying it's supposed to be 2 inches apart, and now I got one every 8 inches, and you kind of go, gosh, I just don't have enough plants here to be able to get any production off this. So it doesn't pay always to use old seed unless you oversow, and then you may have to come back and thin. That's one of the drawbacks.
What about for plants like peas or beans? I tend to like to sow pretty heavy, but maybe I shouldn't be. I haven't noticed a decrease in production, but I don't know.
Tell me. Well, they're pretty good at what we call compensatory productivity. And by compensatory, what we mean, it's a good Scrabble word, if you have enough letters, of course, which you usually don't for one like compensatory. But what that means is that it compensates for the pressure that it's under. If there are fewer plants than desired, the plant tends to grow a little bit bigger and it will throw more flowers, and then therefore your productivity tends to be very equal to what it would be if you had the right number of plants. And if you have too many plants, each individual plant produces less, but the amount of productivity per unit area is the same as if you had it at the right. So when we say by compensating, the plant kind of adjusts for the density that it's under.
Do beans do that?
And
as
beans
well?
Do that, and okay. Peas do that, okay. And melons do that, and there's lots of plants that do it. Usually the ones that don't do that are things that are just like a single stalk, like a lettuce
corn
plant or a corn plant, something like that. Usually we don't see that compensation work out quite as well with
so
those.
I'm okay if I want to use up some older seed.
The older seed. I always say just sow it a little bit heavier. But things like onions and parsnips, it's best to buy fresh seed because you'll get a higher percent germination. And they lose their germination capability very, very rapidly.
Okay, well, our next caller is Susie from Cedar City.
Oh, Susie, you broke the bee spell here. Do you have a bee in your name?
No,
Susie.
In my last name.
Well, that works.
That counts.
Somewhere in there.
Yeah, that works.
I appreciate your program. I'm becoming a regular caller.
Oh, thank you. Happy to hear that.
And I really appreciate what you just said before I get to my question on germination and testing your germination. I have seeds that are over 20 years old. I love living in a dry climate. I live down here where it is dry. We don't have the humidity of your lakes, and come from a place in San Diego where you couldn't store spices, you couldn't store anything.
I know.
And just like in storing spices, you don't want them near the stove or the sink.
Nope.
With my seeds, I store them in a dry closet.
Oh, well, yeah.
And I use those tin cans that we get popcorn in, because I have lots. My garden partner and I grow a big garden. I've got about a third of an acre that I plant.
Oh, goodness.
And so for people who have small gardens with the seeds and stuff, number one, if you overplant, you can pull out those sprites and add them to your salads off time.
That's what I do. Yep.
And they're extremely high in nutrients that way.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I've looked into vertical gardening and companion gardening, which when I didn't have this big piece of property, I did at my home that was only 90 by 95 feet, the square lot of my ground. So those things helped me a lot. And it's easy to go to a library and get books on that.
Yeah.
And companion gardening, like you said about the peas, planting next year, tomatoes where your nitrogen's feed and stuff, that's an awesome way to plant. But so we have this really large garden, and last year we put in over 300 tomato plants, over 125 varieties. My problem is that I ditch irrigate, I'm in town, is the beet leaf hoppers.
Yeah.
We're organic for 20 years now. And so in the early spring, they like to hit my early season crops, my black Russian tomatoes, purple Cherokee purples, things like that, unless they happen to come up by seed, because, you know, if I have a tomato late season and spit out like they do, I just toss it and it comes up volunteer. If they come up volunteer in a thick patch, the beet leaf hoppers don't seem to get them if they're overly thick. But in rows and stuff, they find them and they manage to kill them out. Last year wasn't too bad. I'm wondering in companion or if anything, I don't usually do marigolds and all that, but is there anything I can do to protect them besides having to net every one of 300 plants?
Well, no. And the reason that it's no is because, you know, they're in town, but they're coming off the desert.
I'm only a block away from the mountain.
Yeah, and they're actually coming from the west. They're not not coming off the mountain. They're moving toward the mountain because as it gets warmer and warmer, they go up in elevation. They feed on different plants. So they've been out in the desert feeding. They pick up the curly top problem off of plants that don't show the symptoms, and then they kind of move with the wind into town. And so what we found is the only way to protect them is to really cover them. So particularly when they're small, when the plant gets bigger, and the interesting thing about the beet leafhopper is it only takes one bite.
Right.
On one leaf. It doesn't even like it.
And it doesn't really like it, and it transmits the mycoplasma.
Virus.
Yeah, it's a virus-like disorder. And so, you know, you're just kind of going to have to either...
Do you net it all the way to the ground and tuck it into the dirt? I mean, do I have to do it like cutworms where I have to put it into the dirt?
No, you should be able to...
Or floating row cover?
Yeah, it's a floating row cover works great. And you can buy them that are really wide and really long.
Uh-huh.
And that's what I would do. And then I'd just throw it over top of those tomato plants. And it really only needs it until the plant starts setting fruit or so. Because...
After flowering?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And it's okay with tomatoes because they flower by themselves and they get set by themselves. So
right.
You don't have to do that. And that way, by then, the leafhopper is gone.
Okay.
And then you'll be okay.
Because about 3 years ago, it was terrible, and we lost a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, about that many that we plant every year, we probably lost maybe as many as a fourth of our crop.
Yeah, and that's not uncommon. So I can't help you in any way because...
Well, that wasn't helpful for me. I appreciate your comments.
Okay, good luck with
Thank
that.
Thank you so much.
Thanks,
yep,
Susie.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Well, we have about 1 minute left, so what would you like to discuss very quickly? Oh, warm season crops. Don't plant them yet.
Yeah, don't plant them yet, the first thing. And if you haven't started them and you want to plant your own tomatoes and those kinds of things, normally up in northern Utah, about between the 15th and the 25th of May is when we would plant them. So you probably still have some time. Plants will be still a little bit small, but I see people wanting to buy them at the nurseries and garden centers, and then you have to hold them. And, you know, if you're going to put them out in early April, you better be putting them in a greenhouse or a tunnel. You know, if you're going to go outside in a wall of water, I promise you they're going to have trouble. So good luck with your gardening this week.
Dan, thanks for coming in.
It's a pleasure.
You've been listening to Access Utah. Dan Drost is USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist. He joins the program every first Monday of the month. So stay tuned in May. May, I can't believe I'm talking about May already. Stay tuned for the first Monday in May, and Dan will be back then. Thanks for joining us on this edition of Access Utah.
Bring a little spring indoors by planting a container of fresh green grass. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. Containers of grass make the perfect backdrop for cut flowers or colorful Easter eggs, as well as an indoor play field for action heroes and dolls. Plus, it's easy to do and you'll get quick results. Select a shallow container or decorative pot with drainage holes. Fill with a well-drained potting mix. Cover the soil surface with a quick-sprouting grass seed like rye or wheatgrass. Then gently tamp to ensure good seed-to-soil contact and gently water. Sprout your grass in a bright location and gently water often enough to keep the soil evenly moist. Once the grass sprouts, move to a sunny window. Then water thoroughly whenever the soil starts to dry. Place cut flowers and floral picks and arrange them in your field of grass or display other spring decoration and use your pot of grass as a centerpiece. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.
Support for Utah Public Radio comes from the USU Office of Research and Graduate Studies with Crossroads, featuring the Frye Street Quartet and physicist Robert Davies, Friday at 11:30 in the USU Performance Hall. It's part of Research Week 2012. Online at researchweek.usu.edu.